Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to New Books Network Environmental Studies. I'm Sean Munger. I'm a host on this channel. And today I'm going to be talking to Peter Kupp, and he is the author of Hoptopia, A World of Agriculture and Beer in Oregon's Willamette Valley from University of California Press. I'm Sean Munger. I'm an author, teacher, historian, and podcaster. I have my own podcast called Second Decade, which is on the Recorded History Podcast Network, and you can find it on iTunes. But we're going to go ahead and talk to Peter Kupp about a really fascinating subject, the history of hops and beer in Oregon's Willamette Valley. Hello, this is Sean Munger, host on New Books Network, and I've got Peter Kupp here with us, and he is the author of Hoptopia, A World of Agriculture and Beer in Oregon's Willamette Valley. Hello, Peter.
Hi, Sean. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Thank you very much for coming on. Great book. Really enjoyed it. I'm sure the readers are going to like it. It's kind of an interesting environmental history that I think a lot of people don't know. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and kind of who you are and what areas you work in and what you'd like people to know about you?
Sure. I'm currently associate professor at New Mexico State University, and I'm the director of the public history program. I was raised in Portland, Oregon, and I went to a great undergraduate program at Pacific University, where I fell in love with environmental history, and then got a job working for the Oregon Historical Society and a master's degree, and solidified my interest in environmental and public history. Got a PhD at the University of Nevada with a focus on agricultural history, which people think is a dying field, but is quite vibrant right now.
Well, I think with particularly the bio of your connection to Portland, it shouldn't be any surprise why you eventually fell into writing about beer and the history of beer. But why don't you tell us about how you got interested in the subject? The book is about the history of hops. Is that how you would describe it?
Yeah, yeah.
What brought you to that subject?
Yeah, so the funny thing is the book should have been about the 1915 Panama Pacific World Fair in San Francisco, because that's what my advisor wanted me to write when I was a doctoral student.
Wow. That's really interesting.
And I think he's still upset that I didn't pursue that project. But in any case, it started like many other book projects as a dissertation. And in the summer of 2008, my father and I was living in Reno, Nevada, and I was visiting my folks who had just moved to Aurora, Oregon, from Portland, which is a small town near Salem in the Willamette Valley. And my dad and I were driving around, and all of a sudden I see these hops growing up 20-foot trellises. I'd never seen them in the wild, as I like to say. And I was intrigued, and I did a little bit of research, and I found out that the Pacific Northwest produced a third of the world's hops, which of course are an essential ingredient in beer, along with water and malt and yeast. And nobody had written this history. And I said, well, there's something bigger. there might be something bigger to this story. And I found out way back then that the Willamette Valley in Oregon, which stretches from Portland to about Eugene, in the first half of the 20th century, it claimed to be the hop center of the world. And so the project was born kind of on a whim, on a drive, on a country road with my dad almost 10 years ago. And that turned into a doctoral dissertation. And then I traveled to Europe to do some more of the background research. And it came together, lo and behold.
Yeah, that's interesting, kind of the life cycle of history projects and dissertations. My own dissertation, which is about climate change in the early 19th century, began with an article I remember reading in the sixth grade. So it's kind of interesting how these things happen. So what did you discover about the history of hops and beer making in the Willamette Valley that you didn't know?
Well, a lot, really. It cemented my desire to be an agricultural historian because it touched on so many aspects of the past, from labor and particularly the diversity of labor that harvested hops, the scientific research programs at Oregon State University and Oregon State, Oregon Agricultural College, as it was called prior to the 60s. Labor, science, there's an economic history, obviously. A lot of these small farmers were looking for, you know, after the railroads came in the late 19th century, the small farmers were looking for cash crops to integrate into the, better integrate and accumulate wealth. And so a lot of these farmers just gave up on dairy or wheat, and they turned towards crops that would make more money. And hops became that crop from about the 1890s to the 1940s. So this small specialty crop affected life in the Willamette Valley for a long time. And because of the success of hop growing in the Willamette Valley, the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, pumped in a lot of money, as did big brewers after Prohibition ended. And so the Willamette Valley and the Pacific Northwest more broadly became a center of hop agriculture research innovation, with all those stories of labor and economy and science going along with it. So I was talking with Bill Robbins. Do you know Bill Robbins, emeritus at Oregon State?
I believe I've met him, yes.
Bill just wrote a book about, he just wrote a history of Oregon State University, where I did a lot of my research. And I said early on in his project, "Are you going to write about hops at all?" He's like, "Well, why would I write about hops?" And so, so it's a story that, you know, seems like kind of a side story, but it's actually quite central to life in the Willamette Valley and the global beer economy, right? These hops weren't just used by brewers in the Northwest, but across the Pacific, in Alaska, East Asia, you know, and ultimately Europe, particularly England in the early 20th century. So this small specialty crop touches local history and global history as well. And the more research I did, the more the story grew, and it's a fun project, you know.
Sure, I was very interested in that sort of transition, because at the beginning of the book you talk about how England was really kind of the place where hops were grown, and then how did the Willamette Valley really displace England as the world leader in that?
Yeah, so this is kind of the like a lot of these commodity histories, great commodity histories like Sterling Evans' Bound in Twine or John Saluri's book on bananas. There you have to dig into the global and transnational history. And so what happened in this story is that hop agriculture emerges in Europe around 1,000 years ago and starts spreading. And by the 1700s and 1800s, England and Germany are two of the world leading hop producers. But during the colonial era, English brewers wanted English hops, so they started growing them in North America. And essentially what happened is a pattern of American agriculturalists borrowing everything from agricultural methods to ways to attract labor during harvest from England. And so I call it a transplanted landscape of labor, which is that the model developed in England and then was transplanted to New England, New York, Wisconsin, and the upper Midwest, and then ultimately the virgin soils of the Pacific Northwest that produced more hops per acre in this wonderful climate than most anywhere else in the world. But that also had to do with the virgin soils. And then in England at the same time, there's more diseases and pests. And so the Pacific Northwest supplants England as the world's largest producer by the turn of the 20th century, essentially. I don't know if that all made sense.
Yeah, well, it's just fascinating how, Willamette Valley is not that big. And especially if you think of the medieval, beer going back through the medieval history and ancient history, and such a place that's been settled for such a short time comparative to all that has really become the world leader is just extraordinary, really.
And of course, in the Willamette Valley, of course, it's what we call a windward marine climate. So it's affected by the ocean currents and winds. And there's lots of natural precipitation, obviously, in the Willamette Valley. You live in Eugene, right? Or Portland?
Yeah, I live in the Portland area, yes.
Yeah. So, you have two seasons. You have a wet season and a dry season. But that was perfect for hop agriculture until about the 1930s and 40s when there's a disease introduced called downy mildew. And as you can imagine, a mildew disease does not like all the wetness. So that's when Yakima Valley and Washington State, which is on the other side of the Cascades, which is an arid climate, and they used irrigated agriculture, and it helped stave off this disease that ravaged hop agriculture and across the world.
Yeah, I was interested in that, the downy mildew. I thought that was really fascinating that it had such a huge effect on the industry and really kind of the whole history of this commodity. Just kind of amazing.
Yeah. So, in some ways, I see downy mildew, this plant disease, as one of the main characters in the book. Because what happens, if you take a step back for a second, what this book really asks is, why do the beers of the craft beer revolution smell and taste the way they do? And I answer that through my book. And the answer comes back to the fact that Oregon and Pacific Coast hop growers faced this disease, downy mildew, beginning in 1930, and they had to come up with new solutions. And so they started at Oregon State, they started in Corvallis, they started crossbreeding new hop varieties. And in chapter 9 of my book, I spent a lot of time. It's a scientific history of why we have these new hops, but essentially downy mildew destroyed the varieties they were growing. One called Cluster, another called Fuggle, which are the main hops grown for a long time back into the 19th century at least. But the program at Oregon State started producing these new hop hybrids, and those hop hybrids like Cascade and Willamette, those are the hops that the craft beer crowd picks up on during the 1970s and 1980s. So if you have what's one of the most popular, for example, one of the most popular craft beers is Sierra Nevada Pale Ale. And this was mm-hmm. developed in Chico in the early 1980s, and they used the Cascade hop, which was the first hop released from Oregon State University, but had downy mildew, a term that some hop growers today still don't, they refuse to utter those words. Had downy mildew not arrived to the Pacific Northwest, we wouldn't have had all these new hybrid hop varieties. So it's just one of these interesting turns of events, I guess.
Yeah, it's so fascinating how these things work. You mentioned labor a couple of times. I found that an interesting thread throughout the book, especially when you were talking about the social composition of the labor force that picked hops in the early 20th century. How did you come upon that story, and could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so hops are unique first of all because they grow up on these high trellises and they produce hop cones from top to bottom essentially. And so if you think you're picking zucchini or green beans or something, you can hand pick them right there, and there's not that much per acre compared to hops. Hops required small armies of people to hand pick those high trellises. And so what happened is in the late 19th century, is this is hop growing in the Northwest begins just after the Civil War. There was a scarcity of labor to pick all these hop cones come late August and September. And so the growers would turn to any labor source available. And the most famous grower, a guy named Ezra Meeker out of Puyallup, Washington, he started employing American Indian groups from across the Pacific Northwest, up through, from British Columbia, even from Alaska, from Oregon, and from Washington, because he wanted to he created a new labor system he recognized that American Indians were transitioning to the more cash economy, and this would provide them with the resources they would need throughout the year. So it benefited both these groups. But over time, as hop growing expanded, Meeker and others, they would hire any labor available. And so what this does in the book is it demonstrates that, one, the American West was sparsely populated in the late 19th and early 20th century. But number two, it was extremely diverse. And if you go through all the newspaper records or if you go through the Meeker papers, you realize that all the growers are hiring and recruiting for American Indian, Chinese, Japanese, middle class, lower class, families, urban families, rural families, other hop growers. And so just to fast forward a little bit, after Prohibition in the mid-1930s, the Oregon hop industry required about 70,000 workers per season, which was a tenth of the state's population. And so you just think about everybody that had their hands on those hops producing for the global economy, and there's a really rich story of labor and diversity that I pick up in several chapters of the book.
Yeah, I found that just really fascinating, and kind of how the sort of labor or that immense labor force became just sort of a cross current of sort of cultural communication, really. I mean, the forces were much more diverse than you would have expected at that time.
Absolutely. But also there are, the stories are also alarming to the amount of nativism and racism that existed too. The camps were segregated. So American Indian pickers were segregated from white pickers, were segregated from Chinese pickers, hop pickers. And if you go through the newspapers, the growers are advertising blatantly. They basically say, we want white families to come pick our hops. Now, not every farmer was saying that, but it occurs often enough that it's a trend. That ideally what the growers wanted was a white workforce. But that really didn't happen until about the 1920s and 1930s. So as much as it's about diversity, there's also the reminder of a history of intolerance in the region.
You mentioned the downy mildew as being kind of one of the characters, the main characters of the book. Who would you say are some of the other main characters that kind of weave their way through the story?
Oh, I like that question. Well, I wanted the hop to be the main character, just the idea of a hop being a main character. And so that's why early chapters, they don't even start in Oregon. They start millions of years ago with the story of the evolution of this plant.
Right.
Humulus lupulus L, and how it spread from Asia to across temperate climates across Asia, Europe, and North America. So the hop, first and foremost, the other main characters really pick up with Ezra Meeker, who plants hops after after the Civil War in Puyallup, and he becomes the actually the nation's leader in hop growing. He's going to go to world's fairs and judge hops. He publishes a guide in 1883 for other American farmers to grow hops of high quality. Another scholar just wrote a book on Meeker called Hop King. It's a story of Ezra Meeker's hop years. And so Ezra Meeker became one of the Pacific Northwest's first millionaires just because of his ability, A, to sell hops, but then also to work with other farmers to contract their hops for the global marketplace too. And he becomes instrumental from, I mean, if you look at his records, he's dealing in hops with everybody from Henry Weinhard Brewery in Portland to brewers and across England and Europe. After Meeker, what happens is there's a global, because of weather conditions in the early 1880s, there's a global hop shortage, and the Pacific Northwest is kind of the last player standing. And so Meeker writes his book in 1883, right after that happens. So everybody gets excited about growing hops because they're making lots of money. Ultimately, though, during the Depression of the 1890s, Meeker had extended a lot of loans to small farmers to help them develop hop yards. And because of the Depression in the 1890s, people stopped paying him back. And so his reign as hop king ended by the late 1890s, and he heads up north in search of gold in Alaska and Yukon, which is an interesting end to his story. Mm-hmm. But other players fill in his role. A guy named Horst, who originally started in New York and then California, ends up kind of taking Meeker's place in the Northwest. And he does all kinds of similar activity. Perhaps the most famous thing he did, though, is in the first decade of the 20th century, like Meeker before him, he contracted all of the Willamette Valley's hop growers, and they signed an exclusive contract with Guinness Brewing, which, of course, is the most famous brewery in Ireland. So here, by the first decade of the 20th century, the most famous this famous beer is using Willamette Valley hops. And so these are the kind of stories that I don't know, kind of pop and make it really interesting. So there's several of those characters that pass through, but ultimately the story ends up with the hop research program at Oregon State University. And I had an opportunity throughout my research to get to know a really incredible scientist, a geneticist, a plant geneticist named Al Honnold. Who was born in Austria, the same year that Downy Mildew broke out in the Pacific Northwest, which I think is funny. But he goes to school in Austria. He goes to school at the University of Nebraska. He studies wheat and corn genetics. And ultimately, he gets a job at Oregon State University in the mid-1960s. And he takes the reins of the hop breeding program. And he becomes the most successful hop breeder. So Al is still around. He's a good buddy of mine. And he kind of carries the last couple chapters because it's his work and he and his colleagues' work that led to the hop varieties that we're familiar with in the craft beer revolution. So those are some of the key players.
That I was really interested toward the end of the story about how the science really did become front and center. And I thought that was so interesting how it's like sort of the focus of the book changes where, I mean, originally we're in these, you know, big fields and then we're kind of in these like labor camps, you know, where the growers are. And then we're in the boardrooms and the conventions of the hop growers. And then finally we end up in a laboratory in Corvallis. And I think that's just such a fascinating progression. Also, you mentioned agricultural history too earlier, where I would imagine that, not being an agricultural historian, I would imagine that if you're studying the 20th century in agriculture, probably one of your main focuses is going to be sort of how science and big business and you know, government funding really sort of changes agriculture in a very profound way.
Yeah, absolutely. So the hop story in the Pacific Northwest is interesting because it reflects major trends in American agriculture in terms of modernization and research and mechanization. But it defies a lot of those trends too, because it's a small specialty crop. It's not corn, it's not cotton, it's not wheat. And so what happens is that the hop industry doesn't receive a ton of money from the USDA. In fact, until about the 70s and 80s, it was really the Anheuser-Busch's and the Millers of the world who were working closely with the hop growers and with the scientists at Oregon State University, or at Oregon Agricultural College at the time. And so, you know, if you have a field of wheat in the 1910s and 20s, you're going to transition to using, you know, motorized tractors and so on and so forth. But in a hop field, there's nothing that quite works like that. And so because you're in a more confined space, if that makes sense. And so even when you look at harvesting, right, there's all kinds of combines and harvesters. There's nothing like that on a mass scale for hops, because they're such a small crop, until during the World War II period and later. So that lags a little bit. Now, that said, there's a lot of similarities. For example, in terms of what we call the chemical parade after World War II, the appropriation of wartime chemicals to combat pests in American agriculture. That certainly happens in the hop fields. But once again, part of the story is that the breeding program at Oregon State University was breeding in part to reduce chemicals. They wanted to create disease and pest resistant hops. Does that make sense? So there's a little back and forth on it. It's not as neat and tidy as the story of the major agricultural crops in North America.
Yeah, that is so interesting that it is. I mean, hops are really kind of a different character, I think, than some of the big crops that can build the economy in the mid 20th century. I just find that really fascinating. One of the stories that just amazed me about this was Prohibition. And I was surprised, and perhaps you were too, when you discovered it, that the hops industry in the Willamette Valley actually expanded during Prohibition. How did that work?
Yeah, so this is, I proudly call Chapter 6, The Surprise of Prohibition. The surprise of Prohibition is yes. You would think that without a domestic beer market, that American hop growers would be in dire straits. But what we have to remember is just prior to Prohibition, which goes into effect in January of 1920, we have World War I, the Great War, and European agriculture is ravaged during that period. So it provides another opportunity for Oregon and Pacific Coast hop growers to take advantage of the market situation. So if you look at the agricultural census, almost every year during the 1920s, farmers in Oregon are expanding their acreage. So the surprise of Prohibition is Oregon not only cements itself as the hop center of the world, but it actually expands and takes over Germany.
That's just amazing that it happened like that. Because you would think that Prohibition had so many interesting sort of ripple effects on a number of different industries all over America. And actually, Prohibition came as I recall, Prohibition came earlier in Oregon than it did at the national level.
Yeah, it did. It was a ballot initiative. I think it was passed in 1914. It wasn't enacted until 1916, however, in Oregon. But if you look at the record, if you look through the newspapers and you look through some of the records of growers, these hop growers had spent decades trying to become the hop center of the world, and here prohibition threatened to take it all away. And the irony, unfortunately, is that a lot of the hop growers a lot of the farmers pulled out their hops beginning in the mid-teens, so right around, you know, during World War One, because they couldn't foresee the future that in the 20s, you know, hop agriculture was going to expand again. So yeah, like you were saying earlier, it's just a lot of unexpected consequences, and it's not a straightforward story.
Another feature that I thought really interested me, and you mentioned it earlier, about kind of the big beer manufacturers, we're talking, you know, World War II and afterwards, that was kind of almost a downtime for hops, just because, I mean, you know, we're familiar with those, at least Americans are familiar with those kinds of beers, and they're not very hoppy. So how did that change, or how did that affect the industry, and then how did that change?
Yeah, so after Prohibition, people were hesitant to have reintroduced strong beers quickly to the country. And remember, there's a generation now that's been in Oregon, you have Prohibition in 1916, and so there's not commercial beer, really. I mean, there is to some degree, but not in terms of mass consumption. So after Prohibition, they keep beer pretty light at like 3.5% or 3%. And what that means is there's less malt in it. So if you have less malt, which is the sweet part of beer, then you need less hops, which is the bitter part of beer. And so American hop growers are terrified in the 1930s and 40s, because the big breweries, Anheuser-Busch, Miller, Schmitz, Henry Weinhard's, you know, Olympia, Rainier, all these ones that we're familiar with in the Northwest too, the hop growers are terrified, and they meet with representatives of that industry and say, hey, you need to use more hops. People around the world are using a lot more hops. German brewers use a lot more hops than you all do. It was an interesting time because those big breweries had to rebrand themselves. They created six packs for the first time. Beer consumption transferred from beer gardens and pubs to the household, and so you had to make a product that was seen as safe for everyday consumption in the household. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so.
But what happened is the popularity of beer expands during the 1950s and 1960s. So even though the brewers are not using as many ounces of hops in each vat, they're using more hops because the beer industry expands in the 1950s.
That's such an interesting story, and particularly being from the Northwest, where, you know, Portland, of course. I mean, it's almost a cliche where, you know, the young male hipster in you know, standing on Northwest 23rd Street with a pint of Widmer in his hand.
That was me.
Me too. Yeah. I mean, that's almost a cultural icon. And the end of your book kind of gets into that. I noticed there's several pictures of you know, the 1980s brewers who are these, you know, invariably these, you know, bearded men in flannel, you know, standing in front of a tank somewhere. What about that part of the story? How did that come about?
I mean, the quick way to describe this is that during the 60s and 70s, people were rejecting what we call the bland 1950s Campbell's soup, you know, lack of flavor 1950s and Budweiser, right? Or Miller High Life, and people wanted more. And it we see it in California wine industry. People are interested in more global foods and particularly European and French foods. And so beer follows suit just in terms of a revolution in food more generally. Now, the craft beer revolution begins in San Francisco and in Northern California and expands from there. And Portland doesn't have their first successful craft brewery until really the mid-1980s. The first lasting brewery is Bridgeport Brewing, which was founded by a winemaking family, the Ponzies. And then the first brewer was a guy named Carl Oakard, who has had a tremendous career. He was the first head brewer at Bridgeport Brewery, and he just retired, I saw, in the last couple of weeks. He was leading a Deschutes Brewery in Bend up until the recent past. So anyway, there's a lot of lore behind behind the rise of craft beer in Portland and Seattle and other places. But these bearded guys in front of vats, they work together to acquire malt and hops. And so first it's Bridgeport, and then Widmer Brothers, and Rogue Brewery, which eventually ends up in Newport, Oregon, and McMiniman's, and then Deschutes. And so the rest is kind of history. There was a niche that these brewers served. And today, as you know, Portland has more breweries per capita than anywhere else on the world and is lovingly called Beervana.
True. Very true. Great place to live if you like beer. That's for certain.
That's right. You know, it's funny because whenever I go home to Portland, people want to they ask me, oh, what's hot? What's new in the Portland beer scene? I haven't been able to keep track of it for, you know, a long time now. Everything's happening so quickly. And in Eugene, too, you know, everything's just going nuts. But it's great.
Yeah. I mean, it seems I talk about Eugene. I did my doctorate at the University of Oregon, and we had a little pub right across the street from the history department. So of course, Friday afternoons, you know, the history students are down there getting pints.
That's great.
And it kind of actually burned me out on IPA particularly. And the reason I had so much of it, but the reason I kind of got burned out of it because it was so hoppy. I mean, there were so many hops to it. Have we gone too far has the pendulum swung so far in favor of hops that there's going to be a counter reaction? How do you see that?
I share similar, I have similar thoughts as you, is that I kind of got burned out of IPAs because, you know, part of my research was traveling around the country and traveling to England and back and drinking beer with brewers and hop growers. So I've had a lot of hoppy beer. In the 80s and particularly in the 90s, when Bridgeport released its IPA, that became an iconic IPA. It kind of changed the scene in the 90s. And Fred Eckert, a famous beer writer, said, or maybe it was John Foyston, who wrote for the Oregonian, said that the West Coast style is basically just add more hops. And that's what became the West Coast style of beer. Is that trend over? I don't think it's over. I think it's everybody has their own tastes. The great thing about Portland and the larger craft beer revolution as it continues today is there's so many varieties of beer. You know, one of the founders of one of the founders of Portland Brewing, a guy named Art Lawrence, he developed Cascade Brewery, and they only serve sour beers. I don't know if you've been to Cascade Brewery in Southeast Portland, but they only serve sour beers. So you can go to a brew pub now, and you can't even get an IPA, is what I'm trying to say. There's so many varieties. And like these days, I just like a good craft lager. Well, I live in New Mexico now too, so it's hotter here, and you like a little bit lighter of a beer. But people still love their IPAs, but there's more for everybody now, more of diversity.
Yeah, and that's just so fascinating about the beer, the whole beer world. I don't know if you're when I picked up this book, one of the first things I did was I messaged a friend of mine in England who's known as a kind of a beer aficionado. He's always on there's the social media Untappd. Perhaps you've heard of it, where it's sure. like you, you just kind of, you know, go around and check in. It's like, oh, I'm drinking, you know, a Bridgeport IPA, or I'm drinking this or that or whatever. So, you know, I sent him a photo of the cover of the book, and I'm like, dude, you have to read this. You know, this is this is totally, and it seems like it's that kind of book where it's like, I mean, it's hardcore environmental history, but it's like this book I think could interest people who've never picked up an environmental history book in their lives.
Yeah, that's how I wanted to write it. You know, you have the hook of beer and hops, but really, I don't like to say this, but my goal is to trick people to think more broadly about social and environmental history through the story of hops and beer, right? You get the story of the evolution of plants at the beginning of the book, and you end up with how women are starting to play more prominent roles in the brewing industry in the 21st century. So, I trick everybody with the story of hops and beer, and then there's all this other stuff about diversity and labor and stuff. I think it worked out.
I think so. I mean, it was really fascinating. And, you know, some environmental histories get kind of dry, especially when you do get into, you know, the evolution and there's, you know, that kind of thing. But this was never that way. This was always really very interesting and topical. What kind of sources did you use to, how did you, aside from drinking beer with various European people, which sounds like a great way to do some research, I'm just curious what kind of sources you use.
So that's an interesting part of this project that, you know, it's been basically a decade long project now. When I first started, there was no archive for hop farmers or hop growing. And so I started with the basic resources like the agricultural census and newspapers. But then I had to cobble together kind of an archive from across the Pacific Northwest. And I visited over a dozen, I visited, you know, U of O and Oregon State and University of Washington and to see what the university archives had. But ultimately, I had to go to small historical societies like the Lane County Historical Society, which is where Eugene is, and the Benton County Historical Society, Washington County Historical Society, Marion County Historical Society. And these small little archives, they built the story little by little, right? And people had photographs, and there was labor contracts. There was every visit to one of these little historical societies paid dividends. And then what really changed the game is that I got in contact with an organization called the Oregon Hop Commission. And the administrator there, a woman by the name of Michelle Palacios, she invited me into the world of Oregon hop farming and Pacific Northwest hop farming. And I started to attend meetings, and they, you know, part what I realized about doing a project like this that leads to the present, to conversations in the present day, is that it's really important to develop relationships. So I developed relationships with the Oregon Hop Commission and the various hop farming families. And I started to do oral histories with them. They started to share collections with me. They started inviting me to, you know, family events. One of the, I can't remember if she's still head of the Oregon Hop Commission, but Gail Goshi is a third generation hop farmer outside of Salem, or Silverton rather. And so the research was not straightforward. I had to cobble it all together, right? And then, you know, I finished the dissertation. I said, oh, I need to go to England and figure out the transnational origins of this story. And so it wasn't just, I just didn't go to the Huntington and sit down and do research. I had to develop relationships with families, because for the most part, Oregon hop farmers and Pacific Northwest hop farmers are third, fourth, and fifth generation. So they have that institutional knowledge as part of their family. Now, the end of the story is interesting. After I spent several years cobbling all these archives together, a librarian and archivist at Oregon State University named Tia Edmondson Morton stopped me after a talk I gave at McMiniman's in Portland. And she said, hi, you know, this is really interesting. I'd like to start something called the Oregon Hops and Brewing Archive. I said, that would be wonderful. Why didn't you tell me 5 years ago? So I worked with Tia for a few years, kind of as a historical advisor, introducing her to people, to hop farmers and Al Honnold at Oregon State. And she's just done this tremendous of job. Now there is literally an archive for Pacific Northwest hops and brewing history. It's the first of its kind in its nation. So in my story, it's disappointing. It came after I had done all the research, but it's a great resource for those that are picking up where I've left off in the story.
Oh, that's really interesting. Kind of, yeah, leaving something for the future. Very cool. So what else do you want people to know about this book? Anything really, really surprise you or kind of come out of your research that, I mean, obviously the story about Prohibition had certain surprises, but if there was anything else that was just really amazing to you or noteworthy in your process of research?
You know, there's all kinds of stuff. For example, back in the late 19th century, when you have, I said two of my main characters were a guy named Meeker and a guy named Horst. And they, if you look through their records and their correspondence, they were really cutthroat about the way they did business. For example, they would monitor, they would send their sons and daughters to go scout out farms and try to undercut in terms of how much they're going to pay per pound for hops. So it's really in this story, which seems like a small story, especially crops, there was a lot of cutthroat business, just like anywhere else. The story of Hoptopia is also the story of loss for a lot of people too, because a lot of people invested a lot of money in hops in the late 19th and first half of the 20th century, but then maybe they planted during a down year or when the global marketplace didn't have need for their hops. And so it was a big financial gamble too. But these stories give us insight into the larger rural and agricultural history of the Pacific Coast during this time period.
Very interesting. Very, very interesting. Well, we're kind of coming toward the end. What are you working on next? I'm curious to hear what your next project is.
Sure. I started at New Mexico State University in August of 2012, and a new book project almost fell in my lap, which is there's this character named Fabian Garcia, and he's known for hybridizing the chili pepper that made New Mexico chili famous, essentially. Hmm. And this happened in the first two decades of the 20th century. So in terms of the historiography, I'd already mastered like agricultural and environment during these time periods and the global nature of these stories, but nobody had written a biography or there's only a few articles and book chapters on this guy, Fabian Garcia, but he revolutionized agriculture across the borderlands, not just chili, but cotton, pecans, onions, scores of different crops, and nobody knows the story. We know the stories of people like Luther Burbank in California, who became famous for the russet Burbank potato and all kinds of other crops. We know the story of George Washington Carver, who traveled around the South and Midwest, Iowa. You know, he's the peanut farmer and came up with all kinds of ideas. Uses of peanuts and such, but also did other horticultural work. We know the story of Liberty Hyde Bailey at Cornell, who was the center of, you're probably familiar with the Country Life movement in the early 20th century. People wanted to get back to the land and think about what it meant to be a farmer and stuff during a period of industrialization. But nobody has written about Fabian Garcia, and he is the borderlands horticulturalist that we need to learn about. He was an orphan that was born in Chihuahua, Mexico, the city of Chihuahua and the state of Chihuahua. He ends up in New Mexico with his adopted grandmother in the 1870s or so. He's one of the first graduates of New Mexico State University, at that time called New Mexico College of Agricultural and Mechanical Arts. And he gives his career to improving the agricultural situation of New Mexico, and it trickles across the borderlands, and he becomes a global expert. But nobody knows about this guy. So we have his archives here at the university, along with several other archives, including the family he was adopted into when he arrived to in Mesilla, New Mexico. And so the book I'm writing is called Fabian Garcia and the Chili Pepper Connection. And the Chili Pepper Connection is how his success was dependent. His success in Chile was replicated many other times, but he was successful because he was a product of the border. He spoke Spanish. He was familiar with local farmers on both sides of the border. But also he studied with Liberty Hyde Bailey at Cornell. And so it just demonstrates that the foods we eat and the clothes we wear, cotton clothes, they're products of these environmental and knowledge exchanges in places we might not think about. And so that's what Fabian Garcia and the Chili Pepper Connection, there's a lot of overlap with Hottopia in some ways in trying to tell these agricultural stories.
That's really interesting. And sounds like that book is gonna also be of interest to me, because I love chili, hot foods and spice. I lived in New Mexico too, so that sounds like there is going to be a lot of overlap there. So very cool.
Yeah, from hops to chili.
Yeah, they go well together. Yeah.
Your advisor was Marsha, right? Marsha Weisiger.
She was not my primary advisor, but I did work with her. Yes.
Yeah, she just calls me the hops and chili guy. what
sounds
are
like Marsha? Oh, that's great. Well, Peter, thank you so much for being with us. Really interesting interview and great book. So thanks so much,
Sean. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Great. Okay. Well, we will not take more of your time, but definitely everyone should check out Hoptopia. It's a really, really interesting book. So thanks, Peter.
Yep, thanks again.
Okay. So big thanks to Peter Kupp, associate professor at New Mexico State University, for talking to us about Hoptopia, a world of agriculture and beer in Oregon's Willamette Valley, new in paperback from University of California Press. Really great book, and we want to thank him for joining us. My name is Sean Munger. Remember, I have my own podcast, and I also have a couple of other interviews here on New Books Network. So thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again soon.